And now, Reverend Elizabeth Price has a message for us.
Good morning, everyone. So glad to be back with you. It's been a while. So good to see you. I'm missing some of the regulars, too, so hope all is well with them, and they're having fun in this wonderful spring day. Today, we're thinking about the art of the possible. Many of you might know that it originated as a military phrase, a political phrase. As a negotiation tactic, we want what we want, they want they want, let's see what's possible. The art of the possible. There was also a song in the musical Evita named The Art of the Possible, and it was setting the stage for their nefarious activities in Argentina, the art of the possible. But today, I want to talk about it in a whole different way, the art, the possible. So years ago, in 1970, Apollo 13 was NASA's seventh crewed Apollo mission, intended as the third moon landing, never made it to the moon. Instead, it became one of the most famous successful failures of our lifetimes. When an oxygen tank blew up, really harming their ability to get back home. So the folks back on the ground started cobbling together a plan. They took what the crew had on board, and they tried and failed. Tried and experimented and failed and tried and tried and tried until they were able to come up with a plan to save Jim Lovell, Jack Siegert, and Fred Hayes. They survived this using the lunar module Aquarius as a lifeboat, slingshotting around the moon to propel them back home. And it worked. The theory worked, and practice, it worked. And so one can't help but wonder, 56 years ago, they came up with this solution, and it seems to me that Artemis II used it as the plan to go farther into deep space than anyone had ever gone before. They went farther than the Apollo 13. And this mission, instead of attempting to land on the surface, they wanted to study the dark side of the moon, the other side, the side full of possibilities because we had not ever seen it before. So they laid human eyes on it, believing that human eyes could see things that the cameras and other instruments wouldn't see. And that was true. They took pictures of it. And now we, back here on Earth, in the comfort of our pews and our seats and our recliners, can see the dark side of the moon. Isn't it amazing? It is. And it's a bright spot in our lives today. I've heard many people say, isn't it wonderful to think about that and not be so bombarded with the problems here on Earth? And I would agree with that. The theories or the science of Apollo 13, they created art with it. And the art of the possible became a reality. So that's what we're talking about today. It was so beautiful to me that they thought of this. I don't know if Jim Lovell thought of it or not, but before he died, he recorded a message to the astronauts of Artemis II. And it said something like this. Hello, Artemis II. This is Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell. Welcome to my old neighborhood. I know how busy you will be with all the science. That's my added thing. But don't forget to enjoy the view, the art of it, the art of the possible, now realized. And what a wonderful greeting to have from the Apollo 13 astronaut. So the moon has long enchanted and fascinated humans. And I was showing my picture of, I was always fascinated by the moon. This is my mother and me. I was about 10 years old, and it was around 1970, so we were all kind of focused on the moon that year. And I just love that I have this, because it just reminds me of my relationship with my mother, but also of the fascination that I've had of it with it. So the Artemis mission is named after the Greek goddess who was known for hunting the wilderness, wild animals, transitions, nature, childbirth, and care of children and chastity. She was the twin sister of Apollo, so how appropriate they would name this mission Artemis. She was the twin born first, and one of the myths is that she matured so quickly after she was born that she helped her mother with childbirth of Apollo, and she nurtured and developed and helped him grow and become the god he was. And so she then became synonymous later with the moon. So she was the embodiment of the moon. And then Apollo, he was known for many other things too, but later in mythology became the personification of the sun. So we have Apollo and Artemis in our skies, and Artemis kind of guides and nurtures us at night, which is a scary time for most of us. The dark places are not welcoming. Sometimes they let in all sorts of fears and anxieties. And then we have Apollo watching over us during the day. Perhaps the ancients realized the immense power of the moon over all nature and over human emotions and behavior. So in emergency rooms all across the country, a feeling of dread washes over the staff when the moon is full. Have you all heard about this? Yes. They expect random and horrific onslaughts of violence with patients flooding the place because people do such foolish things under the power of the moon. The ED becomes a kind of NASA-like, problem-solving, artistic, messy, life-saving endeavor with everyone working together using all of their skills, the art of the possible. Oh, and don't forget romance and all the songs written about the moon, the light of the silvery moon, all the movies about moonlight, moonstruck. The moon stirs men and women's hearts toward love like the gravitational pull of the moon with the earth. So much of the Greek and Roman mythology evolved from experiencing the moon's power over our hearts and minds. If only our theories, calculations, manipulations, etc., were enough to find the perfect match. But our theories and mathematics can't really create that. Although the algorithms of Match.com sure have been good to me and to many of us to help us find that person. But once we find them, we can only fall in love. And it's a scary feeling for many of us. It's overwhelming. It takes so much energy right at the beginning, doesn't it? Young love, do you remember it? Are you doing it now? It's just so hard to leave the presence of the person. You're consumed with everything about them. Love every little thing they do, all the moves they make. Remember? Yeah, and that's exhausting. But it's also profoundly a feeling of being out of control. Falling in love is like losing our minds, right? Yes, it is a very powerful experience, and some of us don't do so well with that, that powerful, beautiful, exhausting experience. So it can be very feared by people who experience it as a loss of control or feeling powerless. Art can be painful and messy, like falling in love. Hearts are easily broken when love is not reciprocated or valued. The art of the possible becomes the messiness of the improbable. That's a hard pill to swallow, hard to forgive and move on. With love comes pain and suffering. If you love something, let it go. That's hard to do. A lot of grief, messy, messy grief. But love is messy indeed, and love within a committed relationship changes over time. Thankfully, the gravitational pull love has over our hearts waxes and wanes naturally, giving mere humans space to relax and exist as separate selves with one another's orbit. Then come together at the end of the day. There's always danger in this mission. Fear of falling out of orbit can even create the very thing we fear. Mutual trust is imperative. So I want to share with you this reading, because falling in love and young love, no matter at what age, must mature. It must be like the moon and wax and wane. And the waxing and waning can feel very uncomfortable. So here is Khalil Gibran writing about this very thing. Then Almitra spoke again and said, "And what of marriage, Master?" And he answered, saying, "You were born together, and together you shall be forevermore. You shall be together when the white wings of death scatter your days. Aye, you shall be together even in the silent memory of God. But let there be spaces in your togetherness, and let the winds of the heavens dance between you. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from one cup. Give one another of your bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of you be alone. Even as the strings of a lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping, for only the hand of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together, for the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." Just as exhausting as young love can be, as we mature, we seem to find our rhythm in these relationships. Whether it's with a partner or the rhythm of life itself, being in love with experiencing life. The art of the possible. So So the art of the possible urges us to try and fail, shift expectations of ourselves and one another, go with the flow of waxing and waning energies, enjoy the gravitational pull toward love, practice the art of the possible, and risk the messiness of it all, for we hold all of it dear. In politics, risk working together for all that is just, free, and loving. In romance, risk following the heart into passion. But do the math, think it through, and make peace with the natural rhythms of relationship, as hard as that can be sometimes, as lonely as that can be sometimes. Oh, and don't forget to enjoy the view of that silvery moon, the art of the possible.
We have time for some discussion. Does anybody have any thoughts they'd like to share on the topic?
I love talking about the moon because it's well known, or at least in middle school it was well known when I was a middle school teacher.
It's good.
That if the if there was a full moon, like I can tell when the full moon's happening without knowing the full moon is happening.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to say. Because even in high school, everybody's on edge. Everybody's ready to bite your head off, which is just part of being a teacher. But the teachers are too. And in terms of possibilities, it's a magical time. And I mean that sarcastically, and I mean that genuinely. The moon is sacred. And it's a great time to like come together and have a plan and then see it put into action. Like I know soon the moon's gonna hit again and I'm gonna have to be ready. But you're gonna see these kids freaking out, but they're also at their most vulnerable. And it's a time where you can actually do a lot of good and say, okay, you are crying, and make a connection that you wouldn't have been able to make without it. So that's kind of the genuine magic of the lunar cycle and how it turns kids into demons.
And it opens hearts.
And it opens hearts.
Yes.
So you can see the
Amen.
Amen.
Elizabeth, did you say that patience, there's a concern about patience acting up and being violent if there's a full moon?
People who show up to the ED doing violent things like crashing cars and taking risks unnecessarily. And
okay.
Yes.
Well, I hate to be a downer.
Wah, wah.
And there's always different perspectives on this, but when I worked inpatient unit, psych inpatient, people would always talk about there's a full moon and we better watch out and, you know, and I didn't notice any difference. So I looked it up and I did some research, and the research shows that people don't actually act out during the full moon. That's what this research says. So, sorry.
No, I get that, absolutely.
No, but here's another example. On Facebook, people were talking about, it was Friday the 13th, and there was going to be a full moon, and everybody was kind of freaking out. And so the next day, I said to these folks that were posting this, I said, so what happened last night? Oh, nothing.
Yeah, so a lot of hospital magic like this is superstition, and because people can put it all together to say, yes, this happens. And it seems to be true. Like, I'll ask hospital people, did you experience, how was the full moon? And they'll say, oh, we were swamped. So whether they are or not isn't really as important as how they feel about it, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like a
self-show. Yeah, yeah. But it's all over. There's all sorts. Like, you don't say the word quiet. Hope you have a quiet evening, or hope the shift is quiet. They'll all like, oh, the Q word, you can't say that. Now it's going to be crazy. So yeah, it's really interesting. Yep. The art, not the science.
If I miss this, I'm sorry, but I am interested in the science. Do we have any genuine science as to why this would happen? I mean, for women, it makes sense, the cycles line up with the full moon.
Yes.
But as far as the men goes, is there anything physical, or are they just reacting to what the women are going through? What's happening here?
Okay, we have some men here that can say. It's basically the same thing.
You have your hand up.
Yeah. Well, men are full of water and blood and stuff, so I would think there's waxing and waning, especially the stuff, right?
I think science is always a complicated topic, especially in current times, like who funded the research. But what I love about this particular topic is, and this conversation, is it showcases that you get what you're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. And so, if you're thinking about the art of the possible, you could be looking for the shenanigans, and you're going to find the shenanigans.
Yes.
Because confirmation bias and frequency illusion and all that are absolutely true. And if you're looking for the hope and the possibility in a positive lens, you're going to find that too. And I think because of the way the human brain is wired to lean into the scary stuff as a protective mechanism, of course we gravitate towards the moon is full, instead of the moon is full, woohoo, you know.
Let's go do a circle.
And right.
At night when the moon is full,
right? And I think this to me really just highlights how important it is that we intentionally make sure that we keep as part of our possibility the things that are good. I've said this before, some of you have heard me say this recently, because exhaustion is a strategy, but joy can be our strategy, and we can fuel that by looking for the things that are feeding us in a positive way and keeping us excited about what's coming next and not just always afraid.
So, to answer your question, when I was growing up, now I don't know if this is true or not, but I remember being taught that the moon controls the water. So if you think about it, the moon controls the tides, they come in and out. What is the majority of our body makeup? It's water. So the moon would control us as well, since we do have a lot of water. The bigger the moon, obviously, the bigger the influence.
Art.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Joe.
Do you want to?
No, I was just saying that's art. That's the art of it.
I love the ocean, and I love the moon, and I love that you brought that up, and that the moon's gravitational forces affect the northern and southern poles of the Earth and causes a tide, two tides, technically four, every 24 hours. And I figure if it can affect the tide, gravitational forces, I figure that men probably, and women, are probably shifted to and fro by the gravitational forces, by the cosmic influence, whatever that is. And I love that I'm a druid and I'm totally biased about this, and that Sue is focused on the science and I'm focused on the cosmic energy, and I love that we're kind of getting to meet in the middle here a little bit. It's fun. But yeah, there's a lot of bias. It's super fun. I like it. It's good.
Yeah, and I think this is some of the origins of the phrase art of the possible is taking different views, sharing them, and then expanding each side's views. So if that's the case, it doesn't have to be either cosmic forces or superstitions that aren't really true. It can be all of that because it has sway over us. And then the other point I wanted to make that I didn't put in here, but I'm working on this because our culture loves falling in love and the power of it and that we're consumed by it, and that's like the goal for every person should have this. And then you wake up and you're 40 plus and it's not that amazing anymore. In fact, you know, there's the toothpaste conundrum that's so famous, and they're leaving tissues places, and they're sitting all day long when you want them to go do something, and they're just not who you want them to be at all. And they think, well, what happened? Well, all that power, like the moon, it just waned into something else, and then there's a new moon. How do you renew that passion? Well, you don't necessarily. It shifts. It changes. And we need more stories about that time in life because it's rich and fulfilling, and it's just more of something better, deepening of a relationship. Yeah.
I'd like to expand on this conversation that we're having because I am fascinated by religion and spirituality and superstition and its intersection with science, especially cosmic science, and talking about these celestial bodies that do have a physical effect on our world and even our bodies to a certain extent. We're not very large bodies, so there's not, we don't have much, the moon has a lot more effect on the tides of the ocean than it does on the tides of the water in our body, because we're just not big enough to actually interact in that way. But I have always been very skeptical of astrology and horoscopes, and I still am, but I think it's an interesting idea, because especially after a friend once explained it to me, how everything in the universe is constantly moving at unimaginable speeds and unimaginable distances, and it's just so far away that we can't even comprehend it. What the way he explained it to me is, like, every time a person is born, that moment is a snapshot of what the universe was when you were, where everything in the universe was when you were born. And so a lot of superstitions and the religions that are born out of those superstitions and philosophy and everything that follows after is based on patterns and things that we recognize as realities of our world that humans have always seen, because we've always been intelligent. We've just gathered more information and our collective unconscious has grown, and so we've been able to give more accurate names to these things that we didn't have the information for in ancient times. But there's a reason that people have always worshipped the sun and the moon and the planets and the stars, and it's because these things do have, like, a physical, gravitational, like, heat and energy and light. Like, all of these things descend upon us and influence our world in a way. If there is, like, a literal god of Earth, its soul, our star, our sun, it fertilized Mother Earth, and we grew from the life that was created. Like, that's God. Like, that's, and the moon is, like, I don't know, sort of, but Earth is also kind of mother. It's not directly one-to-one. It's so much more complicated, and that makes it so much more fascinating. And, like, stars and planets, like, the Earth would not function the way it does without the moon and the planets and the sun. Like, everything is in this balance, and whether it's divinely ordained that way or it just happened to end up that way because we're in a fairly uneventful corner of a fairly uneventful galaxy of a fairly uneventful part of the universe. Because if you look at cosmic science and all of these, like, explosions and supernova and, like, all of these collisions, like, everything is chaos. And, like, we just happen to be calm enough for 4 billion years for complex life to evolve. And, like, in the grand scheme of the age of the universe, that's not even that old. Like, we're 13.8 billion years old, the universe is, as far as we can tell, and it's the first several billion years of that, life couldn't happen. It was just too chaotic and too hot, or at least the way we understand
too dense.
And so, like, what's that?
Dense.
Yes.
Dense.
Everything was so tightly packed. You can take these superstitions and these ideas that we've had for thousands, even maybe millions of years, and look at it with what we know today, and it really does kind of track. Like, these things are not literal gods. Like, the moon isn't conscious, but I have a theory that stars are the primary life of the universe because they are the holders and givers of energy, which is literally life. I think the superstition can lead into the science, which makes the reality of our world so much more exciting. Because, like, it's not superstition. Like, the moon, like, it has effect on the seasons, and, like, our moods and feelings and behaviors change with the seasons, and the like, weather and rain and all of this stuff, like, it does affect us. Like, we can feel the temperature and, like, pressure shift and, like, you look out and you see the moon and it's bigger, and, like, even if it doesn't have a physical effect on you, it has that emotional effect. Like, there's a reason those movies are called Moonlight and Moonstruck, and there's so many songs about the sun. One of my favorite love songs is called When the Sun, When the Day Met the Night, and it's about the sun falling in love with the moon, and
yes,
it's just...
that's a good,
like,
one.
It's just...
but they're never
beautiful.
Can be together.
Yeah, that's until one blocks out the other. And that has an effect on our economy. Like, last time there was an eclipse. there were all kinds of articles saying, like, this much money was lost because people were, like, going outside of their jobs to
look at.
And I see that as a positive. But I'll stop ranting and rambling now. I just think that's
amazing. Thanks, Joel.
Okay, we have time for one last comment.
Maybe two?
We can do two. Two last comments, both over here.
I have had a good friend in the early 70s, mid-70s. Before I met her, she was a nurse at Grady Hospital in Atlanta, OB, and the nurses knew that they had more births at the full moon and a little bit more births at the new moon, but they would not staff the hospital better at those times. So they did a 6-month study and tracked them all and proved that indeed they did have more births at the new moon, or full moon rather, and so they got their staffing the way they wanted it. But there are lots of weird connections around. I have this thing, you know, I have a degree in physics and a lot of science background. And the way I look at the world is how do you get much sleep last night? My brain's doing weird things to me. There's very little I believe absolutely, and there's very little I disbelieve absolutely. And that's actually very unscientific, because the history of science is, oh, it's more complicated than we thought. Now, if you had to ask me about, if you made me answer you about what I thought of astrology, I'd say, well, I think it's pretty unlikely. But I won't say absolutely if there's nothing going on there, because would you go back through the history of science, it literally is, oh, this is going to solve everything. Well, the other thing about science is that it does not, it's not bringing us to one great truth. Every time we answer our question, we get more questions, not closer to the answer. So things are really complicated.
I was listening to all the directions people were going, the science, the spiritualness of it, and I was seeing a missing key piece that brings both of those things together very well, and that is the sociality of it. How connecting with people who see the same thing that you see and who hear the same information that you hear and who understand things the way that you understand them because you have shown them everything in the way helps them to believe and feel like they've connected with you. And so I think that the more that we've connected with people other than ourselves and who we connect with people in our community, the more that we see the patterns show up in the way that we see them, in the way that we know that we believe, the way that we think we see the world, and how that best lets us make connections with other people and keep these ideas flowing in the way that they are.
That's a very good point.